I was about to reply when my breath left me, forced out by a cramping pain that seized my stomach again. Simultaneously, another high-pitched screech rocked me backwards. As before, I reached out for Will and saw his face fading out of focus. I struggled to look one more time, then completely lost my equilibrium, slipping again into freefall. Damn, I thought, lying flat on the rock, the coarse surface of the stone edging into my back. I was back at the stream again. Clumsily, I got to my feet, a slight pain throbbing in my ankle, and limped back into the forest. I uncovered my pack and prepared some food, moving very slowly without thinking. Even as I ate, my mind remained surprisingly blank, like after a long meditation. Then, slowly, I began to increase my energy, taking several deep breaths and holding them. Suddenly, I could hear the hum again. As I listened, a spontaneous image came to mind. I was walking east in the direction of the sound, in search of its cause. The thought terrified me, and I felt the old urge to flee. Instantly, the hum vanished, and I heard a rustling of leaves to my rear. I jerked around and saw Maya. "Do you always show up at the right time?" I stammered.
"Show up? Are you crazy? I've been looking for you everywhere around here. Where did you come from?"
"I was down by the stream."
"No, you weren't. I've been looking down there."
She stared at me for a moment, then glanced at my foot.
"How's that ankle?"
I managed to smile. "It's fine. Listen, I've got to talk to you about something. Someone, I don't know who it is doing some kind of experiment, or something like that, here in the valley. I think my friend Charlene is involved somehow, or maybe in danger. Someone in the Forest Service must have secretly approved this." She stared, trying to take it all in. I picked up my pack and took her hand. "Walk with me for a while, please. There's more I need to tell you." She nodded and grabbed her pack, and as we walked east along the edge of the stream, I told her the whole story, from meeting David and Will to seeing William's life review and listening to Joel. When I came to the part about her birth vision, I moved over to some rocks and sat down. She leaned against a tree to my right.
"You're involved in this too," I said.
"Obviously you already know that your life is supposed to be about introducing alternative techniques of healing, but there's more that you intended to do. You're supposed to be part of this group that William saw coming together."
"How do you know all that?"
"Will and I saw your birth vision." She shook her head and closed her eyes. "Maya, each of us comes here with a vision of how our lives can be, what we want to do. The intuitions we have, the dreams and coincidences, they're all designed to keep us on the right path, to bring back our memory of how we wanted our lives to unfold."
"And what else did I want to do?"
"I don't know exactly. I couldn't get it. But it had something to do with this collective fear that is rising in human consciousness. The experiment is a result of this fear. Maya, you intended to use what you've learned about physical healing to help resolve what's happening in the valley. You must remember." She stood and looked away.
"Oh, no. You can't put that kind of responsibility on me. I hate this kind of intrigue. Understand? I hate it. I finally have the clinic set up just as I want. You can't expect me to get involved in all this. You've got the wrong person."
I looked at her, trying to think of something else to say. During the silence, I heard the hum again.
"Can you hear that sound, Maya? A dissonance in the air, a hum? That's the experiment. It's happening right now. Try to hear it."
She listened for a moment, then said,
"I don't hear anything."
I grabbed her arm.
"Try to raise your energy." She pulled away.
"I don't hear a hum." I took a breath.
"Okay. I'm sorry. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not supposed to happen this way."
She looked at me for a moment.
"I know someone with the sheriff's department. I'll try to get in touch with him for you. That's all I can do."
"I don't know if that will help," I said. "Apparently not everyone can hear this sound."
"Do you want me to call him?"
"Yes. but tell him to investigate independently. I'm not sure he can trust everyone in the Forest Service. I picked up my pack again. I hope you understand, she said. I just can't be involved in this. I feel as though something horrible would happen. But that's just because of what happened when you tried this before in the 18th century, here in this valley. Can you remember any of that? She closed her eyes again, not wanting to listen. I suddenly saw a clear image of myself in buckskins, running up a hill, pulling a pack horse. It was the same image I had seen before. The mountain man was me. I shook off the image. It's okay, I said, giving up. I know how you feel. When it happens this way, no one ever does. I picked up my pack and headed east, glancing back once at Maya. She looked guilty for an instant. Then an expression of relief swept across her face. I walked through thick woods toward the sound of the hum, keeping the stream in sight to my left, pausing only to rest my foot. About noon, the sound ceased, so I stopped to eat lunch and assess the situation. My ankle was swelling slightly, and I rested for an hour and a half before I resumed my journey. After covering only another mile, fatigue overwhelmed me, and I rested again. By mid-afternoon, I was looking for a place to camp. I spotted a small grassy knoll near the top of a hill, which looked like a perfect place to spend the night. As I approached, movement in the trees caught my eye. I slipped behind a large outcropping and looked again. What was that? A deer? A person? I waited for several minutes, then carefully moved away toward the north. As I inched along, I suddenly saw a large man 100 yards to the south of the knoll I had seen before, apparently setting up a camp himself. Staying very low to the ground and moving the skill, he deftly raised a small tent and camouflaged it with branches. For an instant, I thought it might be David, but I realized his movements were different, and he was too big. Then I lost sight of him. After waiting for several more minutes, I decided to move further to the north until I was completely out of sight. I'd been moving no more than 5 minutes when the man suddenly stepped out in front of me.
"Who are you?"
he asked. I told him my name and decided to be open. "I'm trying to find a friend."
"It's dangerous out here," he said. "I would recommend that you go back. This is all private property."
"Why are you out here?" I asked. He was silent, staring. Suddenly I remembered what David had told me. "Are you Curtis Weber?" I inquired. He looked at me for a moment longer, then abruptly smiled.
"You know David Lone Eagle."
"I only talked to him briefly, but he told me you were out here and to tell you he was coming into the valley and that he would find you." Curtis nodded and looked toward his camp.
"It's getting late. We need to get out of sight. Let's go up to my tent. You can spend the night up there."
I followed him down a slope and up into the deep cover of larger trees. While I pitched my tent, he fired up his camp stove for coffee and opened a can of tuna.
"You mentioned that you were looking for someone," Curtis said.
"Who?" Briefly, I told him about Charlene's disappearance, and that David had seen her hiking into the valley. Also, that I thought she had been seen coming in this direction. I didn't talk about what had occurred in the other dimension, but I did mention hearing the hum and seeing the vehicles.
"The hum comes from an energy-generating device. Someone's experimenting with it here for some reason. I can confirm that much. But I don't know whether it's being conducted by some secret government agency or a private group somewhere."
He looked out at the valley.
"If I just knew where they were. Counting the private land and the national forest, there are tens of thousands of acres where they might be. I think they want to conduct the experiment and get out before anybody knows what happened. That is, if they can avoid a tragedy."
"What do you mean?"
"They could totally ruin this place, make it into a twilight zone, another Bermuda Triangle, where the laws of physics are in unpredictable flux."
He looked directly at me. "The things they know how to do are incredible. Most people have no idea the complexity of electromagnetic phenomena. In the latest super string theories, for instance, one has to assume this radiation emanates across 9 dimensions just to make the math work. This device has the potential to disrupt these dimensions. It could trigger massive earthquakes or even complete physical disintegration of certain areas.
Well, how do you know all this?
I asked.
His face fell.
Because I helped develop some of this technology. I was employed with a multinational corporation I thought was named Dell Tech, although later, after I was fired, I found out that Dell Tech was a totally fictitious name. This technology is composed of several very dissimilar parts, but basically it works this way. Imagine that the electromagnetic field of the Earth is a giant battery, which can provide plenty of electrical energy if you can tie into it in the correct way. For that, you take a very complicated electronic feedback inhibitor, which essentially mathematically enhances certain static output resonances. Then you tie several of these in a series, amplifying and generating the charge, and when you get the calibrations exact, presto, you have virtually free energy right out of the immediate space. You need a small amount of power to start, perhaps a single photocell or a battery, but then it's self-perpetuating. A device the size of a heat pump could power several houses, even a small factory. However, there are two problems. First, calibrating these mini generators is unbelievably complicated. We had access to some of the largest computers in existence and couldn't do it. Second, we discovered that when we tried to increase the total output beyond this relatively small size by enlarging the mass displacement, the space around the generator became very unstable and began to warp. We didn't know it then, but we were tapping into the energy of another dimension, and strange things began to happen. Once we made the whole generator disappear, exactly like what happened in the Philadelphia experiment. Do you think they really made a ship disappear and show up again in a new location in 1942? Of course they did. There's a lot of secret technology around, and they're smart. In our case, they were able to shut our team down in less than a month and fire all of us without a breach of security because each team was working on an isolated part of the technology. Not that I wondered much about it then. I mostly bought the idea that the obstacles were just too great to proceed, so I thought it was dead-end research. I hadn't thought about the energy experiments in years until I moved into this area. You can imagine how shocked I was to walk into this valley and hear the same sound, this characteristic hum that I heard every day for years when we were working on the project. Someone has continued the research, and judging from the resonances, they're much farther along than we were. I tried to contact two of the people who could verify the sound and maybe go to the EPA or a congressional committee with me, but I found out one had been deceased for 10 years and the other, my best friend when I was at the corporation, was also dead. He had a heart attack just a few days ago. His voice trailed off. Since then, he finally went on, I've been out here listening, trying to figure out why they're in this valley. Ordinarily, one would expect this kind of experiment to be done in a laboratory somewhere. I mean, why not? Its energy source is space itself, and that's everywhere. But then it dawned on me. They must think they're very close to perfecting the calibrations, which means they're working on the amplification problem. I think they're trying to tie into the energy vortexes in this valley in an attempt to stabilize the process. He stopped suddenly. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you heard of the insights? I stared for a moment, then said, Curtis, I have to tell you what I've been experiencing in this valley. You may find it unbelievable. He listened patiently as I described meeting Will and exploring parts of the other dimension. When I came to the life review, I asked, this friend of yours who recently died, was he named Williams?
That's right.
Dr. Williams, how did you know that?
We saw him reach the other dimension after his death. We watched as he experienced the life review.
Curtis appeared shaken. That's hard for me to believe.
I know the insights, at least intellectually, and I believe in the probable existence of other dimensions. But as a scientist,
The ninth insight stuff is much harder to take, literally. The idea of being able to communicate with people after death. You're saying that Dr. Williams is still alive, in the sense that his personality is intact?
Yes. And he was thinking about you.
He looked at me intently as I continued to tell him about Williams' realization that Curtis and he were supposed to have been involved in resolving the fear and stopping this experiment.
I don't understand, he said. What did he mean when he talked about a growing fear?
I don't know exactly. It has to do with a certain percentage of the population refusing to believe a new spiritual awareness is emerging. Instead, they think human civilization is degenerating. This is creating a polarization of opinion and belief. Human culture can't continue to evolve until the polarization is ended. I was hoping that you might remember something about it.
He looked at me blankly. I don't know anything about a polarization, but I am going to stop this experiment.
Williams seemed to understand the process for stopping it, I said.
Well, we'll never know now, will we?
As he said that, I fleetingly saw again the image of Curtis and Williams talking on the grassy hilltop, surrounded by several large trees. Curtis served our food, appearing upset, and we finished eating in silence. Later, as I stretched out and leaned against a small hickory, I glanced up the hill at the grassy knoll above us. Four or five huge oaks made almost a perfect semicircle on its crest.
Why didn't you camp up on the hill? I asked Curtis, pointing.
I don't know, he said. The idea came to me, but I guess I thought it was too exposed or maybe too powerful. It's called Cotter's Knoll.
You want to walk up there?
I nodded and rose to my feet, and Curtis led the way up the slope. At the top, in spite of the fading light, we could see almost a quarter of a mile toward the north and east. In the latter direction, a near full moon was rising above the tree line.
Better sit down, Curtis advised. We don't want to be seen.
For a long while, we sat in silence, admiring the view and feeling the energy. Curtis took a flashlight out of his pocket and laid it on the ground beside him. Presently, Curtis looked over at me and asked,
"You smell something? Smoke?"
I sniffed the air. No, I don't think so.
What kind of smoke do you mean?
Cigar smoke. Dr. Williams smokes cigars that smell just like that.
I can't believe he's gone.
Suddenly, in that moment, I realized that this was the very spot where Williams saw himself meeting with Curtis. It was to take place right here. Seconds later, I observed a figure forming just beyond the trees.
Do you see anything out there?
I quietly asked Curtis, pointing in that direction. As soon as I spoke, the form disappeared. Curtis was straining to see.
What? I don't see anything.
I didn't respond. Somehow I had begun to intuitively receive knowledge, exactly as I had received it from the soul groups, except the connection was more distant and garbled. I could sense something about the energy experiment, a confirmation of Curtis's suspicions. The experimenters were indeed attempting to focus in on the dimensional vortexes.
I just remembered, Curtis said abruptly.
One of the devices Dr. Williams was working on years ago was a remote focus, a dish projection system.
I'll bet that's what they're using to focus on the openings.
But how do they know where the vortexes are? Immediately, I perceived an answer. Someone of a higher awareness pointed them out until they learned the spatial variances as they showed up on the remote focus computer. I had no idea what that meant.
There's only one way, Curtis said.
They would have to find someone to point them out, someone who could sense these higher energy locations. Then they could map out an energy profile of the site and focus precisely by scanning with a focus beam. Probably the individual wouldn't even know what they were doing.
He shook his head. These people are vicious, there's no doubt about it. How could they do this?
As if in response, I sensed other knowledge that was too vague to understand completely, that seemed to maintain
that there was, in fact, a reason. But we had to first understand the fear and how to overcome it. When I looked at Curtis, he seemed to be deep in thought. I wish I knew why this fear is coming up now. During a transition in culture, I said, old certainties and views begin to break down and evolve into new traditions, causing anxiety. At the same time that some people are waking up and sustaining an inner connection of love that sustains them and allows them to evolve more rapidly, others feel as though everything is changing too fast, and that we're losing our way. They become more fearful and more controlling to try to raise their energy. This polarization of fear can be very dangerous because fearful people can rationalize extreme measures. I understand that, Curtis said with certainty. That's why these people are so willing to waste this valley. They rationalize that civilization will fall apart in the future and they won't be safe unless they seize more control. Well, I'm not going to allow it to happen. I'll blow the whole thing sky high. I looked hard at him. What do you mean? Just that. I used to be a demolitions expert. I know how. I must have looked alarmed because he said, don't worry, I'll figure out a way to do it where no one gets hurt. I wouldn't want that on my conscience. A wave of knowledge filled me. Any kind of violence, I said, just makes it worse, don't you see? What other way is there? Out of the corner of my eye, I glimpsed the form again for an instant, and then it disappeared. I don't know exactly, I said, but if we fight them with anger, hate, they just see an enemy. It makes them more entrenched. They become more fearful. Somehow, this group that Williams was talking about is supposed to do something else. We're supposed to fully remember our birth visions, and then we can remember something more, a world vision. A world vision. Curtis pondered deep in thought again. I think David Lone Eagle mentioned that. What do you think a world vision is? I was about to say I didn't know when a thought came to me. It's an understanding, no, a memory, of how we will fulfill human purpose that brings in another level of love, an energy that can bridge the polarization and end this experiment. I don't see how that's possible, Curtis said. It involves the energy level around them, I said, somehow knowing. They would be touched, awakened from their preoccupation. They would choose to stop. For several minutes we were silent. Then Curtis said, maybe, but how do we bring in this energy? Nothing more came to mind. I wish I knew how far they're prepared to go with this experiment, he added. What causes the hum, I asked. A hum is a linking dissonance between the small generators. It means that they're still trying to calibrate the device. The more grating and disharmonious it is, the more it's out of phase. He thought for another moment. I just wonder which energy vortex they're going to focus on. We looked at each other, and in the silence I could hear a faint sound, merely a vibration. Do you hear that? Curtis asked, now alarmed. As I looked at him, I felt the hair rise on the back of my neck and forearms. For an instant, Curtis observed his own arms, then looked at me in horror. We've got to get out of here, he screamed, grabbing his flashlight, leaping to his feet, and half-dragging me off the crest of the slope. Suddenly, the same ear-shattering roar I had heard with Will descended again, and carried with it a shockwave that knocked both of us to the ground. Simultaneously, the earth beneath us shook violently, and a massive fissure opened 20 feet away, creating an explosion of dust and debris. Behind us, one of the towering oaks, undermined by the shifting earth, leaned and then fell to the ground in a thunderous roar, adding to the noise.
seconds later, another, larger fissure tore open right beside us, and the ground tilted. Curtis, unable to hold on, slid toward the widening abyss. I held on to a small bush and reached out for Curtis's hand. For a moment, we held tight. Then, our grip slipped, and I watched helplessly as he slid over the edge. As the dust cleared, I let go of the bush and crawled toward the edge of the massive hole. When I could see, I realized that Curtis was lying prone at the edge, even though I was sure I had seen him fall in. He rolled toward me and jumped to his feet. "Let's go," he yelled. "It could start again." Without speaking, we ran down the hill toward the campsite, Curtis ahead, me limping behind. When Curtis reached the site, he seized both tents and ripped them from the ground, stakes dangling, and stuffed them into the packs. I pushed in the other gear, and we continued toward the southwest until the ground flattened into thick underbrush. After another half mile, exhaustion and my weakening ankle forced me to stop. Curtis surveyed the terrain. "Maybe we'll be safe here," he said, "but let's move deeper into this thicket to the right." I followed as he led us 50 feet further into the dense woods. "This will do right here," he commented. "Let's put up the tents." Within a couple of minutes, both tents were up and covered with limbs, and we were looking at each other breathlessly. "What do you think happened?" I asked. Curtis's face looked gaunt as he dug into his pack for water. "They're doing exactly what we thought," he said. "They're trying to focus the generator on a remote space." He took a long drink from his canteen. "They're going to ruin this valley. These people have to be stopped." "What about the smoke we smelled?" "I don't know what to think," Curtis said. "It was as though Dr. Williams was there. I could almost hear his inflection, his tone of voice, what he would have said in that situation." I caught Curtis's eye. I think he was there. Curtis handed me the canteen. "How is that possible?" "I don't know," I said. "But I think he came to convey a message to you. When I saw him during his life review, he was agonizing because he had failed to wake up, to remember why he had been born. He was convinced that you and he were supposed to be part of this group he mentioned. Can't you remember anything about that? I think he wanted you to know that violence won't stop these people. We have to do it another way, with this world vision that David talked about." He gave me a blank look. "What about when the earth movement started?" I asked, "and that fissure opened. I know I saw you roll in, yet you were lying at the edge when I got there." He looked totally perplexed. "I'm not sure, really. I couldn't hold on and was slipping into the hole. As I dropped down, this incredibly peaceful feeling came over me, and I was cushioned, like falling onto a soft mattress. All I could see was a white blur around me. The next thing I knew, I was lying on the side of the fissure again, and you were there." "Do you think Dr. Williams could have done that?" "I don't think so," I said. "I had a similar experience yesterday. I was almost crushed by stones, and I saw the same white form. Something else is happening." Curtis stared at me for a moment and then said something else, but I didn't respond. I was drifting into sleep. Curtis was already up when I climbed out of my tent. The morning was clear, but a ground fog covered the forest floor. Instantly, I knew he was angry. "I can't stop thinking about what they're doing," he said, "and they aren't going to give up." He took a breath. "By now they've figured out what a mess they made on the hill. They'll spend some time recalibrating, but not for long, and then they'll try again. I can stop them, but I have to find out where they are." "Curtis, violence just makes it worse. Don't you understand the information coming from Dr. Williams? We have to discover how to use the vision." He waved me off with his hand. "I don't want to hear it. This is too crazy. Everything that's happening is my fault. If I hadn't worked on this technology, they might not be doing this. I'm going to handle it my way." He walked over and began tacking. I hesitated, then started taking down my own tent, trying to think. After a moment, I said,
I've already sent for some help. A woman I met, Maya, thinks she can persuade the sheriff's department to investigate this. I want you to promise me you'll give me some time. He was kneeling beside his backpack, checking a bulging side pocket.
I can't do that. I may have to act when I can.
You have explosives in your pack?
He walked toward me. I told you before, I'm not going to hurt anyone.
I want some time, I repeated. If I can reach Will again, I think I can find out about this world vision.
Okay, he said. I'll give you as long as I can. But if they start experimenting again and I think I'm out of time, I'll have to do something.
As he spoke, I saw Will's face again in my mind's eye, surrounded by a rich emerald color. Is there another high-energy location near here? I asked. He pointed south.
Somewhere up the big ridge, there's a rock overhang I've heard about. But that's private land that was recently sold. I don't know who owns it now.
I'm going to look for it. If I can find the right place, then maybe I can locate Will again. Curtis finished packing and helped me tie up my own gear and spread leaves and branches where the tents had been. Toward the northwest, we could hear the faint sound of vehicles.
I'm heading east, he said.
I nodded as he walked away, then pulled my pack onto my shoulders and started up the rocky slope to the south. I traveled over several small hills, then tackled the steep incline of the main ridge. About halfway up, I began to look through the dense forest for an overhang, but found no sign of an opening. After climbing several hundred more yards, I stopped again. Still no outcropping, and I could see none at the crest of the ridge above. I was confused about which way to go and decided to sit down and attempt to raise my energy. After a few minutes, I felt better and was listening to the sounds of birds and tree frogs in the thick limbs over my head when a large golden eagle fluttered from its nest and flew east along the top of the ridge. I knew the presence of the bird had meaning, so, as with the hawk before, I decided to follow. Finally, a half mile further, I pushed my way through a grove of small fir trees, and there before me lay the majestic overhang. Almost half an acre of the slope was covered with huge terraces of thick limestone, and at the furthermost edge, a 20-foot-wide shelf jutted out at least 40 feet from the ridge, providing a spectacular view of the valley below. For an instant, I detected a dark emerald highlight around the lower shelf. At the edge of the rock grew a patch of dense underbrush, so I took off my pack and pushed it out of sight under a pile of leaves, then walked out and sat on the ledge. As I centered myself, the image of Will came easily to mind. I took one more deep breath and began to move. When I opened my eyes, I was in an area of rich blue light, feeling the now familiar sense of well-being and peace. I could detect Will's presence to my left. As before, he looked enormously relieved and happy that I had returned. He moved closer and whispered,
"You are going to love it here."
"Where are we?"
I asked. "Look more closely."
I shook my head. "I have to talk to you first. It's imperative that we find this experiment and stop them. They destroyed a hilltop. God knows what they're about to do next." I closed my eyes and tried to center. Then described the experience of seeing Maya again, particularly her resistance to my suggestion that she was part of the group.
"What was William's message?"
"He confirmed what you and I saw with Maya. He said we could remember beyond our individual birth intentions to a broader knowledge of human purpose, and how we could complete this purpose. Apparently, remembering this knowledge brings in an expanded energy that can end the fear and this experiment. He called it a world vision." Will was silent.
"What do you think?" I asked.
"I think all this is just more of the tenth insight knowledge. Please understand, I share your sense of urgency. But the only way we can help is to continue exploring the afterlife until we find out about this larger vision that Williams was trying to communicate. There must be an exact process for remembering what it is.
In the distance, a movement caught my eye. 8 or 10 very distinct beings, only partially out of focus, moved to within 50 feet. Behind them were dozens more, blended together in the usual amber-colored blur. All of them exuded a particular feeling of sentiment and nostalgia that was distinctly familiar.
"Do you know who these souls are?"
Will asked, smiling broadly. I turned and looked at him. "This is my soul group, isn't it?" With that thought came a flood of memories. 13th-century France, a monastery, and courtyard. All around me a group of monks, laughter, closeness. Then, walking alone on a wooded road, suddenly 2 ragged men, ascetics, asking for help, something about preserving some secret knowledge. I shook off the vision and looked at Will, suddenly gripped by a perverse fear. What was I about to see? I attempted to center, and my soul group edged closer.
"Probe further," Will suggested.
Immediately I saw the ascetics again, and somehow knew they were members of a secret order of Franciscan spirituals, recently excommunicated, after Pope Celestine V had lost his throne.
"Pope Celestine?"
I glanced at Will. "Did you get that? I never knew there was a pope by that name."
"Late 13th century," Will confirmed. "The ruins in Peru, where the 9th insight was ultimately found, were named after him when first discovered in the 1600s.
"Who were the spiritualists?"
"They were a group of monks who believed that a higher awareness could be achieved by extracting themselves from human culture and returning to a contemplative life in nature. Pope Celestine supported this idea and, in fact, lived in a cave himself for a while. He was deposed, of course, and later most sects of the spirituals were condemned as Gnostic and excommunicated."
More memories surfaced. The 2 ascetics had approached me, asking for help, and I had reluctantly met with them deep in the forest. Old documents were in great danger of being lost forever, they told me. Later, I'd smuggled them back to the abbey, and had read them by candlelight in my chambers, the doors closed and locked securely. These documents were old Latin copies of the 9 insights, and I had consented to copy them before it was too late, working every moment of my spare time to painstakingly reproduce dozens of the manuscripts. At one point, I was so enthralled by the insights that I sought to persuade the ascetics to make them public. They adamantly refused, explaining that they had held the documents for many centuries, waiting for the correct understanding to emerge within the church. When I questioned the meaning of this latter phrase, they explained that the insights would not be accepted until the church reconciled what they referred to as the Gnostic dilemma. The Gnostic, I somehow remembered, were early Christians who believed that followers of the one God should not merely revere Christ, but strive to emulate him in the spirit of Pentecost. They sought to describe this emulation in philosophical terms as a method of practice. As the early church formulated its canons, the Gnostic were eventually considered willful heretics, opposed to turning their lives over to God as a matter of faith. To become a true believer, the early church leaders concluded, one had to forego understanding and analysis, and be content to live life through divine revelation, adhering to God's will moment by moment, but content to remain ignorant of his overall plan. Accusing the church hierarchy of tyranny, the Gnostic argued that their understandings and methods were intended to actually facilitate this act of letting go to God's will that the church was requiring, rather than giving mere lip service to the idea as the churchmen were doing. In the end, the Gnostics lost and were banished from all church functions and texts, their beliefs disappearing underground among the various secret sects and orders. Yet the dilemma was clear. As long as the church held out the vision of a transformative spiritual connection with the divine, yet persecuted anyone who talked openly about how one might actually attain such awareness, then the kingdom within
would remain merely an intellectualized concept within church doctrine, and the insights would be crushed any time they surfaced. At the moment, I listened with concern to the ascetics and said nothing, but inwardly I disagreed. I was sure the Benedictine order of which I was a part would be interested in these writings. Later, without telling the spirituals, I shared a copy with a friend who was the closest advisor to Cardinal Nicholas in my district. Reaction came swiftly. Word arrived that the cardinal was out of the country, but I was asked to cease any discussion of the subject and to depart at once for Naples to report my findings to the cardinal's superiors. I panicked and immediately dispensed the manuscripts as widely as possible throughout the order, hoping that I might garner support from other interested brothers. In order to postpone my summons, I faked a severe ankle injury and wrote a series of letters explaining my disability, delaying the trip for months while I copied as many manuscripts as I could in my isolation. Finally, on the night of a new moon, my door was kicked down by soldiers, and I was beaten severely and taken blindfolded to the castle of the local noble, where I later languished at the stock for days before being decapitated. The shock of remembering my death cast me into fear again and created a powerful tingling in my injured ankle. The soul group continued to move several feet closer until I managed to center myself. Still, I was left with a degree of confusion. A nod from Will told me he had seen the entire story. This was the beginning of my ankle problem, wasn't it? I asked. Yes, Will replied. I caught his eye. What about all the other memories? Why would the church create such a dilemma? I asked. Because the early church was afraid to come out and say that Christ modeled a way of life that each of us could aspire to, although that is what is clearly said in the scriptures. They feared that this position would give too much power to individuals. So I was a fool for trying to circulate the insights. I wouldn't say a fool, Will mused, more like undiplomatic. You were killed because you tried to force an understanding into culture before its time. I looked into Will's eyes for another moment, then drifted back into the knowledge of the group, finding myself at the scene of the 19th century wars again. I was back at the meeting of chiefs in the valley, holding the same pack horse, apparently just before departing. A mountain man and a trapper, I was friends with both the Native Americans and the settlers. Almost all the Indians wanted to fight, but Maya had won the hearts of some with her search for peace. Remaining silent, I listened to both sides, then watched as most of the chiefs had left. At one point, Maya walked up to me. I suppose you're leaving, too. I nodded affirmatively, explaining that if these native medicine chiefs didn't understand what she was doing, I surely didn't. She looked at me as though I must be kidding. Then, turning, she directed her attention to another person. Charlene. I suddenly recalled that she had been there. She was an Indian woman of great power, but often ignored by the envious male chiefs because of her gender. She seemed to know something important about the role of the ancestors, but her voice was falling on deaf ears. I saw myself wanting to stay, wanting to support Maya, wanting to reveal my feelings for Charlene. Yet, in the end, I walked away. The unconscious memory of my mistake in the 13th century was too close to the surface. I wanted only to run away, avoid any responsibility. My life pattern was set. I trapped for furs, I got along, and I didn't stick my neck out for anyone. Perhaps I would do better next time. Next time? My mind raced forward, and I saw myself looking outward toward the earth, contemplating my present incarnation. I was watching my own birth vision, seeing the full possibility of resolving my reluctance to act or to take a stand. I envisioned how I might utilize my early family to its greatest potential, learning spiritual sensitivity from my mother, integrity and fun from my father. A grandfather would provide a connection with the wilderness, an uncle and aunt
would provide a model for tithing and discipline. And being placed with such strong individuals would bring my tendency to be aloof quickly into consciousness. Because of their ego and strong expectation, I would at first retreat from their messages and try to hide. But then I would work through this fear and see the positive preparation they were giving me, clearing this tendency so that I could fully follow my life path. It would be a perfect preparation, and I would leave that upbringing looking for the details of spirituality I had seen in the insights centuries before. I would explore the psychological descriptions of the human potential movement, the wisdom of the Eastern experience, the mystics of the West, and then, eventually, I would run into the actual insights again, just at the time they were surfacing to be brought finally into mass awareness. All the preparation and clearing would then allow me to further explore how these insights were changing human culture, and to be a part of William's group. I pulled back and looked at Will. "What's wrong?" he asked. "It hasn't exactly gone the ideal way for me, either. I feel as if I've wasted the preparation. I haven't even cleared myself of the aloofness. There were so many books I didn't read, so many people that could have given me messages that I ignored. When I look back now, it seems as though I missed everything." Will almost laughed. "None of us can follow our birth visions exactly." He paused suddenly and stared. "Do you realize what you're doing here? You just remembered the ideal way you wanted your life to go, the way that would have given you the most satisfaction. And when you look at how you actually live, you are filled with regrets. Just the way Williams felt after he died and saw all the opportunities that he had missed. Instead of having to wait until after death, you're able to experience your life review now." I couldn't quite understand. "Don't you see? This has to be a key part of the tenth. Not only are we discovering that our intuitions and our sense of destiny in our lives is a remembrance of our birth visions, we understand the sixth insight more fully. We're analyzing where we have been off track or failed to take advantage of opportunities so that we can get back on a path more in line with why we came. We're finally becoming aware of a process that has been unconscious since human experience began. From the start, humans have perceived a birth vision. And then, after birth, have gone unconscious, aware of only the vaguest of intuitions. At first, in the early days of human history, the distance between what we intended and what we actually accomplished was very great. And then, over time, the distance has closed. Now we're on the verge of remembering everything. As from a great height, a large holographic image opened up around me, and I could somehow see, in one glance, the long saga of human history. Without warning, I was drawn into the image, and I felt myself being swept forward into the story, reliving it somehow in fast forward, as if I had really been there, experiencing it, moment by moment. Suddenly, I was witnessing the dawn of consciousness. Before me was a long, windswept plain somewhere in Asia. A small group of humans, unclothed, were foraging on a field of berries. Intimately connected to the rhythms and signals of the natural world, we humans lived and responded instinctively. The routines of daily life were oriented toward the challenges of the search for food and membership within our individual band. Levels of power flowed downward from one physically stronger, attuned individual. And within this hierarchy, we accepted our place in the same way we accepted the constant tragedies and difficulties of existence, without reflection. As I watched, thousands of years passed by and countless generations lived and perished. Then, slowly, certain individuals began to grow restless with the routines they saw before them. When a child died in their arms, their consciousness expanded, and they began to ask, why? And to wonder how it might be avoided in the future. These individuals were beginning to gain self-awareness, beginning to realize that they were here, now, alive. They were able to step back from their automatic responses and glimpse the full scope of existence. Life, they knew, endured through the cycles of the sun and moon and seasons. But as the dead around them attested, it also had an end. What was the purpose? Looking closely at these reflective individuals, I suddenly realized I could perceive their birth visions. They had come into the earthly dimension with a specific purpose of initiating humanity's first existential awakening. And, even though I couldn't see its full scope, I knew that in the back of their minds was held the larger inspiration of the world vision. Before their birth, they knew humanity was embarking on a long journey that they could already see. But they also knew that progress along this journey would have to be earned generation by generation. For as we awakened to pursue a higher destiny, we also lost the calm peace of unconsciousness. Along with the exhilaration and freedom of knowing we were alive, came the fear and uncertainty of being alive without knowing why. As the awakening continued, millennia passed, and I watched as humans gradually began to coalesce into even larger groups, following a natural drive to identify with more people, to move into more complex social organizations. I could see that this drive came from the vague intuition that human destiny on Earth was to evolve toward unification. Following this intuition, we realized that we could evolve beyond the nomadic life of gathering and hunting and begin to cultivate the Earth's plants and harvest them on a regular basis. Similarly, we could domesticate and breed many of the animals around us, ensuring a constant presence of protein and related products. With the images of the world vision deep within our unconscious, driving us archetypically, we began to envision a shift that would be one of the most dramatic transformations in human history, the leap from nomadic wandering to the establishment of large farming villages. But the whims of nature and the challenges of life still pierced the awareness of early humanity, and the unspoken question still loomed, why were we alive? As before, I watched the birth visions of those individuals who sought to understand spiritual reality at a higher level. They came into the Earth dimension to specifically expand human awareness of the divine source. But their first intuitions of the divine remained dim and incomplete, taking polytheistic form. Over thousands of years, the multitude of farming communities coalesced further into large civilizations in Mesopotamia, Egypt, the Indus Valley, Crete, and northern China, each inventing their own versions of the nature and animal gods. I watched generations of souls come into the earthly dimension, intending to bring a message that humanity was destined to progress by sharing and comparing knowledge. Yet, once here, these individuals succumbed to the fear and distorted this intuition into an unconscious need to conquer and dominate and impose their way of life on others by force. For thousands of years, different empires bubbled up to the top of humanity's consciousness, decimating their ideas, rising for a time with a more effective reality, economic plan, and war technology, only to be later deposed by a stronger and more organized vision. Ever so slowly, old, outdated ideas were eventually replaced. I could see that, as slow and bloody as this process was, key truths were gradually making their way from the afterlife into the physical dimension. One of the most important of these truths, a new ethic of interaction, began to surface in various places around the globe, but ultimately found clear expression in the philosophy of the ancient Greeks. As I watched, this new way of interaction began to emerge and take form on Earth, finally becoming known as democracy. At the same time, another watershed idea, one destined to completely transform the human understanding of spiritual reality, was surfacing in the written histories of a small tribe of the Middle East. Similarly, I could also see the birth visions of many of the proponents of this idea as well. These individuals, born into the Judaic culture, knew before birth that while we were correct to intuit a divine source, our description of the source was flawed and distorted. Our concept of many gods
was merely a fragmented picture of a larger whole. In truth, they realized there was only one God. A God, in their view, that was still demanding and threatening and patriarchal, and still existing outside of ourselves, but for the first time, personal and responsive, and the sole creator of all humans. As I continued to watch, I saw this intuition of one divine source emerging and being clarified in cultures all over the world. In China and India, long the leaders in technology, trade, and social development, the religions of Hinduism, Buddhism, and other Eastern religions moved the East toward a more contemplative focus. Those who created these religions intuited that God was more than a personage. God was a force, a consciousness, that could only be completely found by attaining what they described as an enlightenment experience. Rather than just pleasing God by obeying certain laws or rituals, the Eastern religions sought connection with God on the inside, as a shift in awareness, an opening up of one's consciousness to a harmony and security that was constantly available. Quickly my view shifted to the Sea of Galilee, and I could see that the idea of one God that would ultimately transform Western cultures was moving from the notion of a deity outside of us, patriarchal and judging, toward the position held in the East, toward the idea of an inner God, a God whose kingdom lay within. I watched as one person came into the Earth dimension remembering almost all of his birth vision. He knew he was here to bring a new energy into the world, a new culture, based on love. His message was this: the one God was a Holy Spirit, a divine energy, whose existence could be felt and proven experientially. Coming into spiritual awareness meant more than rituals and sacrifice and public prayer. It involved a repentance of a deeper kind, a repentance that was an inner psychological shift based on the suspension of the ego's addictions, and a transcendent letting go that would ensure the true fruits of the spiritual life. As this message began to spread, I watched as the most influential of all empires, the Roman, embraced the new religion and spread the idea of the one inner God throughout much of Europe. Later, when the barbarians struck from the north, dismembering the empire, the idea survived in the feudal organization of Christendom that followed. At this point, I saw again the appeals of the Gnostic, urging the church to focus more fully on the inner transformative experience, using Christ's life as an example of what each of us might achieve. I saw the church lapse into the fear, its leaders sensing a loss of control, building doctrine around the powerful hierarchy of the churchmen, who made themselves mediators, dispensers of the spirit to the populace. Eventually, all texts related to Gnosticism were deemed blasphemous and excluded from the Bible. Even though many individuals came from the afterlife dimension intending to broaden and democratize the new religion, it was a time of great fear, and efforts to reach out to other cultures were distorted into the need to dominate and control. Here I saw the secret sects of the Benedictine and Franciscans, who sought to include a reverence for nature and a return to the inner experience of the divine. These individuals had come into the Earth dimension, intuiting that the Gnostic contradiction would eventually be resolved, and determined to preserve the old texts and manuscripts until that time. Again, I saw my ill-fated attempt to make the information public too soon, and my untimely departure. Yet I could see clearly that a new era was unfolding in the West. The power of the church was being challenged by another social unit, the nation-state.